Hello, this is Derek Frost from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from the Triangle Business Journal. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. And we start on the front page of the Triangle Business Journal. The headline across the top of the page: Med Schools Remain Magnet for Students. This article is written by Jason DeBrun with a dateline of Chapel Hill. And the article runs horizontally across the top of the page. On the far left, there's an aerial photograph of the top of a school. The caption reads, "Campbell University's Med School is on the planning boards." Despite the high cost, hard work, and a seemingly endless trail of training, medical schools across the U.S., including at UNC, are attracting applications in record numbers. In fact, applications nationally have increased nearly every year since 2002, including at UNC. Between 2009 and 2011, applications to UNC rose from 4,116 to 4,720. Nationally, the increase in applications was from 562,694 in 2009 to 609,312 in 2011. At Duke, applications have actually decreased by 8% since 2009, from 4,967 to 4,581. To Brenda Armstrong, Duke Medical School Director of Admissions, the drop is negligible, particularly since Duke accepts only about 100 students each year. "The actual numbers don't bother us at all because of the quality of the pool that we are getting, especially from the elite undergraduate schools in the country," she says. Additionally, a high percentage of students who receive offers from Duke accept. This year, Duke did not make a single offer to those on its waiting list, those students who qualify for acceptance but do not initially receive offers. For nationwide figures, the economy plays a role in the increase of applications. As most industry sectors are showing stagnation or decline, most projections show healthcare spending will increase. The Plunkett Research Group, for example, estimates healthcare expenditures will increase from $2.76 trillion in 2010 to $3.62 trillion in 2016. "Obviously, the economy plays a role," says Dr. Warren Newton, Vice Dean for Education at the UNC School of Medicine. Driving the point home, Armstrong notes that medical students have a guaranteed job after graduation in the form of a residency. Even after residency programs, the need for primary care physicians will likely increase. According to research by Campbell University, North Carolina already has fewer primary care physicians at 8.8 per 10,000 residents than the national average of 9.43 per 10,000. Campbell is set to open a $60 million School of Osteopathic Medicine, for which it received pre-accreditation approval in early October. Newton made clear that the need for general practice physicians should not be confused with the need for just any kind of doctor. Students are increasingly choosing to go into specialized and more lucrative fields, something he says concerns him because it could mean a lack of care in other areas. A survey in the Journal of the American Medical Association backs that up, finding that only 23.2% of medical students intend to enter a career of internal medicine, with only 2% going into general internal medicine, or primary care. The rest plan to pursue a specialized or combined field for a variety of reasons, including better work schedules and compensation. The Association of American Medical Colleges applauds the high number of applicants, particularly the rising number of minority applicants. "This diversity will be important as these new doctors go out into communities across the country to meet the healthcare needs of all Americans," says Dr. Darrell G. Kirch, AAMC president and CEO. In 2011, the number of black applicants to medical schools increased by 4.8%, and the number of enrollees increased 1.9%. For Hispanics and Latinos, the number of applicants increased by 5.8%, and enrollees increased 6.1%, according to the AAMC. And our next article, on the front page of the Triangle Business Journal, takes up most of the page. It starts in the middle of the page and goes down. It has a black border around it. Inside that border, the top half is a picture of a woman, a clerk, in an ABC store stocking shelves. The caption reads, Channy Pearson stocks gin at an ABC store on Sandy Forks Road in Raleigh. And then under that in bold black lettering is the headline, The ABCs of Liquor Sales. Folks are still drinking, but doing so more at home. And this article was written by Jason DeBrun with a Dateline of Raleigh. The sour economy has not stopped people from consuming liquor, but they're doing so more at home than in bars and restaurants. That's the conclusion to be drawn from an analysis of data on liquor sales statewide through municipal and county ABC systems. Both individuals and bar operators buy liquor in North Carolina through the local systems. This year, individual sales increased by 2.9% to $601 million, whereas sales to bars and restaurants increased by nearly a full percentage point less, 2%, to $146 million. Paul Stone, president of North Carolina Restaurant and Lodging Association, says the economy clearly has consumers economizing. In general, people are going out less, he says, and when they go out, they spend less money. Instead of buying a $10 martini, they might have a $4 beer, he says. Still, liquor sales are an important source of revenue for local governments. This past fiscal year, which ended June 30, Wake County Alcoholic Beverage Control recorded $82 million in sales at its 23 stores. For the year, it generated $12.6 million in profit, good enough for a 15.3% profit margin. The next highest margin was in New Hanover County, where 8 stores recorded a 13.1% profit margin from $31.6 million in sales. Since 2002, the earliest year for which data is available, Wake has consistently been at the top of the profit margin list among local systems, with exceptions only for accounting anomalies such as property sales artificially boosting operating profit. Profits generated and taxes collected are distributed at the end of each fiscal year. This year, Wake sent $25 million in taxes to the State General Fund and another $3.8 million to Wake County. It also gave $3.7 million for independent alcohol education and rehabilitation programs, including $1 million for the Larry B. Zverink Senior Alcoholism Treatment Center. Our product does create some societal problems, and we want to help mitigate those by giving back to the community and to programs that can help, says Craig Pleasance, general manager of the Wake County ABC Board. We have always strived to be a very efficient operating system, and we take pride in being able to give back to the community. In terms of size, Mecklenburg County is Wake's only comparable ABC board. It reported $99 million in sales last year and $11 million in net income, or a 11.1% margin at its 22 stores. Mecklenburg ABC board CEO Paul Stroop credits Wake with running a very efficient operation and says his board operates somewhat differently. For one, the county is contiguous to South Carolina, where state liquor taxes are lower. Also, Mecklenburg puts an emphasis on clean stores, convenient locations, and a well-trained staff. I think we deliver pretty effectively on that, Stroop says. In the state legislature, some lawmakers want North Carolina to privatize liquor sales. Last year, some Republican candidates used that issue to help bolster their campaigns, but talks never materialized this summer, mainly because the state had other issues. There are a whole lot of moving parts on this, says Tom Murray, a Republican from Wake County. Murray says he is keeping his eye on Virginia lawmakers because the two states run similar systems, and Virginia has pursued a privatization. I think it's a mistake not to analyze it, he says. And we have one last article on the front page of the Triangle Business Journal. This one runs vertically along the right side of the page. First, at the top, it has the picture of the outside of a Golden Corral store, one of the newer ones. And the caption reads, Golden Corral continues to grow most of its operations. And then under that, there's the headline, Golden Corral operator looks to divest stores. This article is written by Amanda Jones Hoyle with the Dateline of Raleigh. One of Golden Corral's largest franchise operators, Frisch's Restaurants Incorporated, is looking to sell 29 buffet restaurants in the Ohio River Valley region after hiring an investment banking firm to evaluate its Golden Corral business segment. Frisch's shut down 6 of its 35 Golden Corral restaurants in August due to underperformance, and the Cincinnati-based company announced on October 12 that it had hired Brookwood Associates of Charlotte to evaluate its Golden Corral portfolio for a possible sale to another restaurant operator. Raleigh-based Golden Corral, one of the heavyweights of the restaurant industry that has continued to grow its revenue even during the downturn in the economy, has been working to replace many of its older stores. The new stores feature more seating and buffet space for an expanding range of food items, including cook-to-order sirloin steaks, weekend breakfast buffets, and even cotton candy machines. But not all franchise owners have been able to keep up with the changes and still be able to keep a steady customer stream coming through the door. Sam Yates, an analyst with VGB Securities Incorporated in Arlington, Virginia, who tracks publicly traded Frisch's restaurants, says Frisch's leaders have admitted mistakes such as building some Golden Corral locations too close together, leading to a cannibalization of revenue by sister stores. It hasn't worked for them, and they're facing up to that now, Yates says. By his estimates, Frisch's has invested close to $100 million in its Golden Corral portfolio since opening its first franchise in 1999. The book value of those stores stood at only $69.5 million at the end of the company's fiscal year. Frisch's Restaurants, which is the only publicly traded franchisee of privately held Golden Corral, also owns or licenses 121 Big Boy restaurants in Ohio, Kentucky, and Indiana. Frisch's reported that same store sales in its Golden Corral segment declined by 4.9% in the company's first quarter that ended September 20. Profit from its Golden Corral stores declined by 39% as a result of lower same-store sales, the store closures, and higher food and paper costs. The restaurant sector is so competitive, and I attribute part of this to a challenged consumer who doesn't have as much money to spend, Yates says. It makes it hard to make money. Yates doesn't blame the Golden Corral brand for Frisch's troubles. I've eaten there a couple of times, and I think it's a great concept, he says. But for Frisch's, unfortunately, it hasn't worked. Golden Corral Corporation, which is led by co-founder James Maynard, owns 95 Golden Corral units across the country and has another 386 units operating under its franchising system, says Larry Tate, Golden Corral Senior Vice President of Franchise Sales. The company reported revenue of $1.64 billion in 2010, a 5% growth compared to the year prior, even though the chain had three fewer stores in operation. Tate says the company is on target to surpass that total in 2011. Nationally, Golden Corral ranks at number 28 among the largest restaurant franchise concepts in the country, according to the Franchise Times trade publication. It's the only grill buffet restaurant concept on the list. The cost to launch a new Golden Corral franchise also ranks among the most expensive. The initial franchise fee is $50,000 per restaurant, and a franchisee must have more than $2.5 million in net worth and more than $500,000 in available capital to qualify. An initial investment in a Golden Corral restaurant is between $1.9 million and $6.8 million, according to the company. Frisch's restaurant still has area development agreements with Golden Corral that permit it to open another 25 locations in the Ohio, Indiana, Kentucky, and Pennsylvania regions. But Frisch's chief financial officer, Mike Lanning, says those deals will probably never happen. I'm not sure if those agreements are transferable, but if we sell the properties, that'll go with them, Lanning says. And now we turn inside the Triangle Business Journal to the Biz column. The headline that starts it off, UNC System Cuts 11 Positions to Meet New Budget. It's not just faculty losing their jobs in the state's university system. 11 positions have been eliminated in the offices of the UNC system, headed by Thomas Ross, to deal with budget cuts. The positions were not identified in a report in the Daily Tar Heel, but the system's main duties involve providing oversight and guidance to all university campuses in the areas of academic and student affairs, government relations, and research. The cuts come in the wake of a 15.6% reduction in state funding for the system this summer. That's a cut of about $414 million. in place have their salaries frozen as they're taking on more work to make up for positions lost to attrition and layoffs. It's the third year UNC system employees have not gotten pay raises. Throughout the university system, the last 3 years have been a tough time, William Fleming, UNC system vice president, told the DTH. Two 1965 Duke University graduates who live in New York City have made a $1.25 million gift to establish an endowed faculty chair in the law school. Jeffrey Hughes graduated from the school in 1965, but spent most of his career in finance, including more than two decades at Lehman Brothers. His wife, Betty Sue Hughes, graduated from Duke Women's College in 1965. The school says the gift, along with a matching grant from the Stanley A. Starr Matching Gift Fund, will help it add leading legal scholars to its faculty. Golf Digest is out with its annual list of best new golf courses in America, and the Dormy Club outside Pinehurst is number three. Topping the list is Old MacDonald at Bandon Dunes in Bandon, Oregon, and second is Patriot Golf Club in Owosso, Oklahoma. Other North Carolina courses on the list are number 16, Carmel Country Club, South Course in Charlotte, and number 23, Sequoia National in Whittier. For $250, you can sit courtside in Cameron Indoor Stadium and watch Coach K and his staff run the 2011 to 2012 Blue Devils through a preseason practice, and it's all for a good cause. The proceeds will go to the Emily Krzyzewski Center, a Durham nonprofit serving academically focused low-income students through out-of-school programming. The $250 ticket includes dinner in Scharf Hall with Coach K and his staff, after which the coaches will answer questions. The event is November 8 and begins at 5 p.m. Boo! It's that time of year to go looking for ghosts in haunted places, and by the reckoning of one magazine, all you have to do is drive to Chapel Hill, or if you live in Chapel Hill, just walk over to the Carolina Inn. Reader's Digest Canada recently featured eight haunted hotels in North America, and the Carolina Inn and its resident ghost, Dr. William Jaycox, finished at number one. That's a second listing for the inn, which About.com voted among its top 10 haunted hotels. The legend of Dr. Jaycox begins in 1948 when he took up residence in the hotel, in room 256 to be exact, and lived in that room for 17 years before he died. Even though his soul passed, it's said that Dr. Jaycox's ghost lives on at the inn. Sometimes it's said, mischievously locking current guests in room 256 out of the room. Now here's a good deed for Fido and all his friends. Invisible Fence, which sells and installs electronic fencing to keep pets from straying outside a yard, has donated pet oxygen masks to each of the Durham Fire Department's 16 stations. The $60 mask will enable firefighters to administer oxygen to dogs and other animals rescued from burning structures. The donation is part of Invisible Fence's Project Breathe, which has the goal of equipping every fire station in the U.S. and Canada with pet oxygen tanks. By donating the pet oxygen masks, we hope to help save more pets and prevent pet owners from losing a beloved four-legged family member while dealing with the devastation from the fire. Vance Bryson, Assistant Director of Retail Operations with Invisible Fence of Raleigh, said, "What a great idea." The Better Business Bureau of Eastern North Carolina and Coastal Federal Credit Union attracted more than 400 participants for the semi-annual Secure Your ID Day on October 22. Cintas Document Management and Shred Ace had shredder trucks on site to shred documents containing sensitive information. Toby Barfield, president and CEO of Better Business Bureau, serving Eastern North Carolina, noted that more than 9 tons of documents were shredded during the event at the credit union's office on St. Albans Drive in Raleigh. The BBB's next shredding event will be in April 2012. Acme McCrary, an Ashboro clothing company, is considering expanding from 50 to as many as 110 jobs at its operations in Siler City. The Siler City government is considering an incentives package to entice the company. It sounds very promising, Siler City Mayor Charles Johnson told the Chatham News. I think they would be a good community partner. The Chatham County Economic Development Corporation has been working on the deal for more than a month, says EDC President Diane Reed. Wake County hotels were busy in September, with an occupancy rate of 63.2%, up by 2.5% over September 2010. Year-to-date occupancy is running at a 62.9% occupancy, up 7.2% over 2010. Those numbers are better than the statewide average of 57.2% and the national average of 61.6%, says the Greater Raleigh Convention and Visitors Bureau. Rates also are up in Wake from an average of $82.52 per room night to $84.35. The Umstead Hotel and Spa in Cary has been named among Condé Nast Traveler magazine's top 200 best hotels in the U.S. as part of the mag's annual 2011 Reader's Choice Awards. The Umstead ended up at number 41 on the list. Other North Carolina hotels making the rankings were the Ritz-Carlton in Charlotte at number 5 and the Inn on Biltmore Estate in Asheville at number 17. The winners are chosen by Condé Nast Traveler readers who vote on thousands of hotels, cities, and islands based on their visits. Siler City, delightfully unexpected. That's the working motto for the Chatham County town as leaders work through development of a new branding process with Greenville, South Carolina-based Arnett Muldrew & Associates. A slew of slides is available at the website, www.downtownbranding.com/SilerCity. For those interested in seeing where the development process is headed, the slides depict logos, brochures, flags, and more. Frankly, Biz prefers this slogan, "If Siler City was good enough for Aunt B, it's good enough for you." Contributing to Biz were staffers Jason DeBrun, Amanda Jones-Hoyle, and Chris Bagley. And now we return to the full-length articles in the Triangle Business Journal. The first one we come to has the headline, Durham Exec Launches Firm Buying Banks. And this article is written by Lee Weisbecker with a Dateline of Durham. John A. Williams, a Triangle Biosciences executive with a community banking past, is engineering a deal to buy up North Carolina banks that regulators have ruled need new ownership. Williams, CEO of Durham-based Biosignia for 5 years, and a group of investors has offered to purchase a controlling interest in Rocky Mount-based First Carolina State Bank and in PIGSA Community Bank of Asheville. The deal is currently under review by the Federal Reserve and the North Carolina Commissioner of Banks. The dollar amount of the transaction has not been disclosed. The seller is Lansing, Michigan-based Capital Bancorp, a one-time $5 billion holding company that owned 50 community banks from North Carolina to California. Over the past months, Capital has been divesting itself of those properties one by one after being slammed by problems in its real estate lending portfolio. There was a set of issues that brought them down, but that was the primary one, says Daniel Cardenas, a Chicago-based analyst for Raymond James. Cardenas, who does not own stock in the firm, no longer follows Capital on a regular basis. Capital stock now trades in the 7 cents range. The firm's divestiture of community banking properties has been a process urged along by regulators. In June 2010, the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation ordered the board of First Carolina State to engineer either a buyout or merger to get the $95 million total asset lender out from under Capital. Williams, a former Rocky Mount resident and Edgecombe County commissioner, First Carolina State Bank co-founder and board chairman, had long since moved on to other endeavors. A Cary resident now, he considers guiding the fortunes of Biosignia, which develops risk assessment technology used by life and health insurance companies and others, a full-time occupation. Even so, when his old bank got into difficulties, he decided it was time to become involved again. Using a Durham-based investment group, First Carolina Financial Services Incorporated, he began raising money and negotiating the buyout. Investors taking part include Rocky Mount's Robert R. Malden, a former chairman of Centura Bank and current Biosignia board member, Donald Stallings, Charles A. Robbins, Jr., and Greenville businessman John J. Farabee, Jr., according to a fellow investor and the investment group's secretary, Thomas A. Betts. The group is applying to the Federal Reserve to become a bank holding company. Williams declined to reveal the group's target amount. The ultimate plan is to pump $17.5 million in fresh capital into the two banks, First Carolina, with branch offices in Rocky Mount, Greenville, and Reidsville, has lost $11 million over the six quarters ending June 30. PIXA, with $30 million in total assets, has lost $12.5 million over the same period, according to the FDIC. Williams says the aim is to get the banks back on firm ground and operating as active community lenders. There is an opportunity for each in their own markets, he says. In my opinion, there has never been a better time to start a bank, given the low interest rates we have. With those low rates starting off, a bank, as it rises, is going to make money. In our next article, it's in the center of page 3. It has a black border around it. Inside that border, at the top, there's a picture of some people checking their luggage at an airport. The caption reads, Gary and Susan Mitchell check in their bags before their flight out of RDU to Colorado. Then under that, in bold black lettering, there's the headline, Bagging it at RDU. To avoid fees, travelers cram luggage full. And this article was written by Chris Bagley with a dateline of Morrisville. Fees related to baggage and other items have taken on a major role in the airline industry, influencing both carriers' profitability and their customers' traveling habits. Some airlines began charging for each checked bag in 2008. Most have since raised those fees to the range of $10 to $40 per bag, sometimes with exceptions for business class travelers and frequent flyers. Fees for oversized and overweight bags, while not entirely new, have grown more frequent and are being levied above lower thresholds. The fees have come as a welcome revenue stream as the industry struggles to stay profitable amid a choppy economy, rising fuel prices, and ferocious competition on base airfares. Passengers haven't been altogether surprising in their responses, more carry-on and fewer checked bags, but some observers say they've been amazed at just how far travelers go to avoid checked bag fees. Anyone who has flown recently knows the drill for carry-on luggage. Pack it full and try to board the airplane before the overhead bins fill up. The last dozen or so carry-on are often carted down to the plane's cargo hold. We try to see if we can get it all in a carry-on, says Mark Traphagen, an online marketing manager in Durham who travels frequently with his wife. The Traphagens used to check a bag or two for extended trips, he says. No longer. With each item, they ask themselves if it's worth its weight. They're not alone. American Airlines spokesman Tim Smith says American checks an average of 0.9 bags per passenger, down from 1.1 before 2008. The carriers don't track the weights of individual bags, but Smith and other airlines representatives say they believe rising fees may have limited the numbers of overweight bags being checked. Baggage handlers, for their part, say they believe some passengers are stuffing a single piece of luggage to just below the fee threshold instead of checking two smaller bags. We might be getting fewer bags now, but they're heavier, says Glenn Jeans of Transport Workers Union Local 569, which represents American Airlines baggage handlers, also known as rampers, at Raleigh-Durham International Airport. Rotator cuff injuries, long an occupational hazard, have grown more common for rampers, Jeans says. Domestic carriers' total revenue from baggage fees more than doubled in 2008 and 2009, rose by 20% last year to $3.4 billion, and is on track for a smaller increase in 2011, according to the U.S. Department of Transportation. Those airlines' total fee revenue amounted to $15 billion from the first quarter of 2008 through the first quarter of this year. While the agency doesn't break down that total in terms of cost and profit, analysts look at it as mostly profit, and it dwarfs the $2.2 billion in total earnings the department shows for the industry in those nine quarters. Federal data show Delta Airlines, Raleigh-Durham's number two carrier by boardings, collecting $952 million in baggage fees in 2010, a period for which the Atlanta-based carrier reported net income of just $593 million. they're not so much a driver of airline revenue as airline profit, says Hunter Key, a financial analyst with Wolf Trahan in New York. Airlines have come to treat tickets as a sort of loss leader, much the same way some convenience stores do with the per-gallon fuel prices posted out front in order to sell higher-margin items to customers inside the store. While airlines disclose their fees for baggage and the various other items, Key says the prices still are not quite as transparent and easily comparable as base fare prices, which can appear almost instantaneously on third-party itinerary planners such as Expedia.com and Travelocity.com. Still, airlines with relatively light fee schedules advertise the fact aggressively. Southwest Airlines, Raleigh-Durham's leading carrier by boardings, has trademarked its "bags fly free" slogan. A $50 fee does still apply to each bag after the first two, and to each bag that weighs more than 50 pounds. Southwest spokesman Chris Main says the Dallas, Texas-based airline has gained market share of about 1 percentage point since 2008, due at least partly to other carriers' fees. The next article in the Triangle Business Journal is written by Jason DeBrun with a dateline of Raleigh. The article runs vertically on the page. At the top, above the article, there's a picture of a man in coat and tie. The caption reads, "Jim Whitehurst heads up Red Hat." And then under that is the headline, "Red Hat targets public sector for steady growth." Tripling revenue in 5 years is impressive for a company of any size. It's even more impressive when a company goes from $341 million in revenue to more than $1 billion, as Red Hat projections show in that same period of time. Now, thanks to a probable increase in government contracts, those numbers could increase at an even faster clip. In 2004, the open-source software company launched a division, or a vertical in tech lingo, focused on government work. Red Hat doesn't break out revenue from its verticals, but Paul Smith, general manager and vice president of the public sector division, says government revenue is outpacing the 28% growth of the company as a whole. Chaitanya Yaramada, an analyst for Robert W. Baird, estimates that government contracts made up about 9% of Red Hat's 2009 revenue, 10% in 2010, and was the fastest growing segment this year. In 2004, Red Hat employed 5 people to work on government contracts. Now it has a department with 150 dedicated employees and partnerships, with another 150 workers focused on government. Another initiative at Red Hat, which is helmed by Jim Whitehurst, involves its aggressive move into cloud computing. In early October, the company acquired Gluster Incorporated for $136 million in cash. Chief Technology Officer Brian Stevens at the time said the acquisition would help converge big data and the cloud, a server-based system that allows users to access data from any device. Open source development and Red Hat's core has changed how software innovation happens. Years ago, engineers would work for a technology company to improve on products for customers. Now, thanks largely to how interconnected everything is, developers from everywhere are making those innovations, some from their homes or personal computers. These upgrades happen nearly daily and can be minor and difficult to track or implement. That's where Red Hat comes in. Its open source developers track all the minor innovations, make a few of their own, and package it all into an upgrade every 6 or 12 months. In looking for ways to cut costs, Dell Tech, itself an enterprise software company based in Virginia, predicts the federal government will increase its demand for software from outside vendors by as much as 6.3% a year to $13.7 billion in 2016. With open source gaining mainstream acceptance, Smith says Red Hat is in prime position to take advantage. He says the government spends as much as $80 billion per year on information technology, with 70% of that being outsourced. Analysts agree with Smith's outlook. In general, open source solutions are gaining acceptance, Yaramada says. People are realizing that they are secure and can perform well. In the past, the government has primarily been concerned about security, but is beginning to look to open source because of their lower cost. Trip Chowdhury, a senior analyst who covers Red Hat for global equities, says Red Hat has positioned itself well to take advantage of the open source market, and if the federal government looks there, Red Hat could stand to gain. He points especially to a new cloud-first policy by which government contractors are encouraged to suggest cloud-based solutions for the federal government's IT needs. Treasurer picks SaaS to analyze investment risks. That's our next article, written by Lee Weisbecker with the Dateline of Raleigh, and it's accompanied by a picture of the SaaS sign that's at the opening to their entrance. The caption reads, SaaS is a leader in risk analysis. North Carolina pension system managers have chosen Cary-based SaaS over three other vendors to assess the various kinds of risk embedded in the state's $74 billion investment portfolio. Under the contract, SaaS will customize a platform to track the system's investments across all fronts: stocks, bonds, real estate funds, hedge funds, venture capital, and private equity. The initial term of the two-year $1.7 million contract runs until July 2013 and may be renewed, says pension system spokeswoman Julia A. Vail. The Department of State Treasurer will benefit from this multi-year contract through competitive fees based on joint development work of both organizations, says Vail. The goal will be to track the gains and losses of individual investments and portfolios and how they stack up against benchmarks, calculate the volatility of excess returns, measure system performance during extreme market swings, and estimate the potential losses that could spring from external events, human or system failures. It'll also help pension managers decide whether the state's money is being invested in the right places. Increasingly, since the financial turmoil that began in 2008, managers of pension systems and other large pools of money have been shelling out dollars for the most sophisticated analysis they can obtain of the market and other uncertainties they face. North Carolina State Treasurer Janet Cowell and her staff looked at the risk assessment platforms of a total of four vendors before tapping SaaS. They also reviewed in person or by phone the risk management practices of eight other pension or money management organizations, including Duke University Management Company, which manages Duke Investments, the Wake Forest University Endowment, CalPERS, the California Public Pension System, and a trio of Canadian pension operations. As a final test, SAS was required to run through a proof-of-concept risk assessment involving the system's $27 billion in bond holdings. SAS has many years of experience in risk analytics and has a client list that includes some of the largest financial service firms worldwide, says Vail. SAS, co-founded by former NC State University professor Jim Goodnight, is on a short list of companies with the analytic wherewithal to track risk factors in a $70 billion portfolio. New York and London-based Chartis Research prepares an annual list of the leading tech providers in the field based on buyer practices. In 2010, the latest year available, the top five providers were SAS, Algorithmics, SunGard, Oracle, and Fiserv, according to Chartis' Payman Mechian. North American spending on risk technology was projected to go to $6.5 billion by 2012, the group says. One of the most challenging aspects of the task, says Paula Henderson of SAS's state and local government practice, is the need to pull in widely scattered data from the small army of third parties involved in handling North Carolina pension investments. The data integration part of it, she says, adding that SAS, with a long list of financial services clients, including investment banks, has had a lot of practice overcoming that hurdle, the company does not provide a client list. We've been impressed with the sophisticated approach the treasurer's office has taken with this project, says Henderson, and we're glad the state is looking at ways of reducing risk. And our next article in the Triangle Business Journal has the headline, Six Banks in Area Continue to Face Regulatory Oversight. And this article was written by Lee Weisbecker with the Dateline of Raleigh. North Carolina is in the middle of the pack among the 50 states in the number of banks still operating under significant enforcement actions issued by regulators. In the Triangle and nearby counties, the number is 6. Nationwide, as of October 12, according to David Hayes of Charlottesville, Virginia-based SNL Financial, some 1,042 banks and thrifts were operating under orders issued after January 1, 2007. That's roughly 10% of U.S. banking institutions. Only Vermont and West Virginia managed to escape without a single bank or thrift under severe enforcement actions, Hayes says. At the top of the pack are 6 states, Georgia, Florida, Texas, California, Minnesota, and Illinois, with 50 or more banks under orders and heightening regulation. In the 26 to 50 bank range, the next group of states came Alabama, Tennessee, Missouri, Kansas, Colorado, and Wisconsin. North Carolina, with 91 state-regulated banks, was included in the third rung of 20 states, with from 11 to 25 banks under regulatory orders, says SNL. 18 states, the final group, had from 0 to 10 banks under orders. The regulatory actions, which came in the form of orders for prompt corrective action, consent orders, or cease and desist orders, were issued either by the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation, the Federal Reserve, the now restructured Office of Thrift Supervision, the Office of the Comptroller of the Currency, or state regulators. In the Triangle region, banks still operating under orders are Four Oaks Bank in Johnston County, written agreement with Federal Reserve May 2011, Greystone Bank, Raleigh, consent order with FDIC April 2011, Harrington Bank, Chapel Hill, consent order OTS August 2009, Community One Bank, Ashboro, cease and desist order, OCC, July 2010, now merged with Bank of Granite. Cornerstone Bank, Wilson, consent order, FDIC, February 2010. First Carolina State Bank, Rocky Mount, consent order, FDIC, March 2010, now under new ownership. A majority of the community banks in the Triangle region and on the national list came under higher regulatory scrutiny for problems centered in their real estate and construction lending portfolios. In most instances, the regulators directed the banks to beef up their capital reserves and tighten lending standards. Banks normally stay under such orders for 18 to 24 months, depending on how long it takes management to resolve the issues raised, says banking expert and former regulator Don Coker. Coker says he believes the rate at which additional banks are now coming under formal regulatory actions has begun to slow. Also moving in a positive direction is the number of banks on the FDIC's problem list, down by 23 to 865 at the end of the second quarter. Amanda Jones Hoyle wrote our next article with the dateline of Apex. The headline on the article: Manufacturing beginning to show signs of life in region. And along with this article, there's a picture of three men casually dressed, standing with some sort of equipment. The caption reads, Dwayne Perry, Robert Little, and Keith Morris with ATI Industrial Automation in Apex. 2 years after declaring an end to their company's recession, Keith Morris and Robert Little of ATI Industrial Automation will break ground on an expansion of the company's headquarters in Apex, with plans to add 50 jobs over the next 3 years. ATI Industrial Automation took it on the chin when leaders in the automotive industry, including General Motors and Ford Motor Company, were forced to restructure the way they produced and sold cars. ATI specializes in the design and assembly of customized robotic implements used on large manufacturing assembly lines, but with most manufacturers across the country cutting back on production, so also were contracts to buy ATI products. Our sales dropped 40% in the first half of 2009, and we had to lay off people, which is a hard thing to say when you are a growth company, says Little, the chief operating officer. ATI's employee count dropped to 94 people from a peak of 120 in 2008. When that wasn't enough, several of the company's engineers and assemblers volunteered to cut their hours to part-time status to help carry the company through the summer. But once the U.S. automakers came out of bankruptcy and settled into a new routine, work started trickling back in. By Labor Day 2009, all of ATI's volunteer part-timers were back to full-time status, and the company was able to hire back 8 of the people laid off earlier in the year. Most of the others had found other jobs, Little says. ATI now employs about 150 people at its plant in Apex's Pinnacle Park. Manufacturing in the USA has started to recover, Little proclaims. September employment figures seem to support that claim, at least for North Carolina's Triangle region. Manufacturing companies in the Triangle employed about 62,600 people in September, according to the Employment Security Commission of North Carolina, which was up from 62,300 people employed in manufacturing industries at the end of 2010. We have seen a slight upswing of people wanting to do more productive programming projects like Six Sigma and ISO management systems, says Robert Crew, a regional manager for NC State University's Industrial Extension Service, which works with small and medium-sized manufacturers across the state to improve their productivity. It's been 2.5 years of stagnant investment in people and processes, he says, but in the last month we've started seeing improvements in companies getting contracts. Maine Plastics Incorporated, for example, reworked its lease in September to expand its space in Apex by nearly 42,000 square feet. Maine Plastics is an Illinois company that recycles and resells plastic materials. It opened the facility in Apex in 2010, so it could be near one of its largest clients, medical device maker BD, which has 3 production plants in the Triangle region. In Zebulon, plastic thermoforming product maker, API Incorporated, leased an additional 75,000 square feet in a warehouse building near its headquarters on Mack Todd Road in the third quarter. ATI CEO Keith Morris says his company will be adding 20,000 square feet of space to one of its 2 buildings in Apex with an investment of about $1.25 million. The groundbreaking is set for November 3, and the building is expected to open in early 2012. The true test, however, will be how long it takes ATI to outgrow the expanded space, he says. Little anticipates the company will need a total of 100,000 square feet of space under one roof within the next 5 to 10 years. That's our biggest challenge now, he says. Robert McKenna, president and CEO of the National Motor and Equipment Manufacturers Association, that's based in Research Triangle Park, says about 5% of North Carolina's manufacturing employees are involved in the automotive parts supply business, and most of them are seeing upswings in sales. After Chrysler and GM came out of Chapter 11, the automaker's business started coming back nicely in a more moderate pace. Now the manufacturers of cars and trucks are doing pretty well, and the parts suppliers are doing well as well, McKenna says. Raleigh's parking system pays off to tune of $1.5 million. And that's the headline on our next article, this one written by Chris Bagley with a Dateline of Raleigh. An upgraded and expanded system of meters downtown has eased workday parking crunches and generated nearly $1.5 million for the city, municipal officials, and downtown merchants say. It also has become a source of headaches for drivers whose coins and credit cards are occasionally rejected, for others who resent paying for what used to be free, and for merchants who worry that paid parking may be deterring customers. The 161 pay stations cover most street parking in the 20-block area bounded by Dawson, Morgan, Wilmington, and Lenore streets. Installed in early 2010, they replaced 400 coin-only meters that covered a fraction of that area. An additional 32 stations replaced 100 coin meters along Hillsborough Street. The city has collected $1.47 million from the stations, including $1.14 million in the city's 2011 fiscal year. Assistant Parking Administrator John Wynn says that compares to an annual average of $121,000 from traditional coin meters that were in use in the previous 3 years, Wynn says. The pay stations are designed to accept nickels, dimes, quarters, Visa, and MasterCard. After parking, a driver walks a half block or so to one of the stations, enters the parking space on a keypad, and then inserts coins or types in the amount to be charged to the credit or debit card. Time limits apply in certain areas, as they did with the coin meters. The new system responded to business owners' complaints that downtown employees were crowding out customers, staying in free spaces, and rotating their cars so as not to overstay time limits, say city officials. Matt Tomasulo, an entrepreneur who frequently meets clients downtown, says he used to ride his bike to avoid the hassle of parking, but that's not always a good arrangement, he says. I'm delivering things and don't have a lot of time, says Tomasulo, who founded the t-shirt company City Fabric and is studying urban planning at UNC Chapel Hill. I never used to be able to find parking downtown. I almost never have a problem now. John Blomquist, however, thinks the parking fees may be hurting business at Berkeley Cafe on Martin Street, which he owns. When you're trying to get business downtown, why meter them to death? Blomquist asks. What's more, Blomquist says drivers often have trouble using their credit and debit cards in the meters. The meters don't accept bills, so they walk into the cafe for coins. I'm giving change half the time, Blomquist says. And our next article in the Triangle Business Journal is written by Chris Bagley with the Dateline of Raleigh. The headline, Gas Electric Service Cutoffs Up in North Carolina with Sour Economy. Utilities are disconnecting more customers who don't pay their bills, an increase that mirrors a recent rise in North Carolina's jobless rate. While company representatives say their own profit isn't dented significantly and directly by the non-payments, their effect is to magnify the general rate increases that other customers face in most years, because regulators allow utilities to recoup the collection costs and lost revenue. Public Service Company of North Carolina, which provides gas in the Triangle and a large swath of western North Carolina, says it cut service to 22,418 households in the first 9 months of the year, up by 6% from the same period in 2010. Duke Energy Carolinas, Progress Energy Carolinas, and Dominion North Carolina Power, the state's three major electricity providers, have cut electricity to 162,591 households, according to year-to-date reports from the North Carolina Utilities Commission. Those totals are up by about 1% from the same periods in 2010, reflecting larger increases for Duke and Dominion and a slight decline for Progress. Totals for Progress, which serves Wake County, Points East, and a large area around Asheville, don't fully reflect customers' hardship, spokeswoman Lauren Bradford says. The company has worked out alternative payment arrangements for about 400,000 customers who are having trouble paying, 12% more than in the first 9 months of 2010, Bradford says. Any alternative is preferable to disconnection, PSNC spokeswoman Angie Townsend says. We try to engage early with our customers that are having difficulties, Duke spokeswoman Paige Lane says. Duke doesn't count the number of payment arrangements it offers each year because hardship-related arrangements are so ad hoc, Lane says. By law, utilities generally can't disconnect a customer's service until the customer is 60 days late on a bill. Some customers also get a break in the winter. Data from PSNC and the Utilities Commission show all the companies cutting off service in December, January, and February less frequently than in most other months, either because customers are more diligent about paying then, or because of corporate policies. Utilities have periodically announced curtailments of payment-related disconnections. Two out of three customers respond to cutoffs by making a payment, Lane says. Of those, nearly 70% pay within 24 hours. Utility cutoff numbers have generally mirrored unemployment and other trends in the broader economy. Electric utilities numbers peaked in 2007 and 2008 as foreclosure numbers were rising dramatically. PSNC's numbers show the most dramatic increase mid-decade during a generally strong economy. Townsend says that resulted partly from a dramatic spike in natural gas prices after Hurricane Katrina interrupted supplies from the Gulf of Mexico. Disconnections fell along with gas prices in 2009, according to PSNC data. And for our remaining minutes, we'll read from the TriangleBusinessJournal.com. Here are some of the news you may have missed on TBJ's website. Quintiles acquires Advion. Durham-based Quintiles Transnational Corporation said Wednesday that it has signed a definitive agreement to acquire Advion Bioservices, a smaller, more specialized contract research organization headquartered in Ithaca, New York. The acquisition significantly adds to Quintiles' testing services in the areas of pharmacokinetics, the study of how the human body processes drugs, and pharmacodynamics, the study of how drugs act on the body, according to Senior Vice President Tom Woolman. It's definitely an additive kind of merger, says Woolman. Raleigh apartments sell for $56 million. The Tribute apartment complex off Glenwood Avenue in North Raleigh has been sold for $55.85 million, according to Wake County tax records. Richmond, Virginia-based DCO Glenwood Urban LP sold the 359-unit complex to Creft Tribute LLC, which is associated with Connecticut-based Cornerstone Real Estate Advisors LLC. The tax value of the property is $42 million. The Tribute, which was built in 2010, sits on 24 acres of land. Global Knowledge sold. Cary-based Global Knowledge has a new owner after one New York investment group bought it from another. Global Knowledge does information technology training with a specific focus on Cisco, Microsoft, VMware, Red Hat, business process improvement, and leadership development, according to its website. New York City-based MidOcean Partners announced Tuesday that it has acquired Global Knowledge, though it did not disclose financial terms of the deal. MidOcean Partners bought Global from fellow New York City company Welsh, Carson, Anderson, and Stowe. Piedmont investing in Crescent. Raleigh-based Piedmont Community Bank Holdings Incorporated says it has received regulatory approval to invest $75 million in Crescent Financial Corporation, a transaction that will leave it with a majority interest in the Cary-based bank. Piedmont chairman and Chapel Hill businessman Adam Abram will become chairman of Crescent Financial, while Piedmont CEO and Raleigh banker Scott Custer will become CEO of Crescent Financial. Final closing of the deal is expected in late November. And I'm going to stop there as we've run out of time for today's episode of Triangle Business Journal. Be sure to listen at the same time next week. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Derek Frost, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. This program is readily available as a podcast after the broadcast. So long until next time.